Well, hi there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast, a special edition for the bank holiday weekend here in the United Kingdom, Memorial Day in the United States. Bank holidays apparently commemorate banks in Britain. I'm sure that they'll change the name soon, given where the banks have gone. Anyway, it's a bank holiday Monday, Sunday actually today, and Monday's coming up. And untrue to form, the weather's been beautiful, so I'm spending a lot of time outside with the baby and having a great weekend. I hope you're having a lovely weekend too, wherever you happen to be. This podcast is going out a day early because we're going to the zoo all day tomorrow. Some recent news. Last night, I had the great pleasure to attend the latest White Mischief Club Night here in London. This is the Steampunk Club Night, and I ran into several listeners. Nice to see you all, some of whom found out about the event through this podcast. For those of you who are visiting London or live in London, the White Mischief Steampunk Nights at the Scala in King's Cross are really amazing. Have a look at my Flickr stream under the White Mischief tag to have a gander at what it all looks like. It's really just something else. I've also just outlined a new short story for a Jonathan Strahan theme anthology about Mars. This story is going to be called The Martian Chronicles, and it's going to be a story about the MMOs that the colonists destined for Mars play. And it's going to be a story that explains questions related to space travel and big science, class, racism, and authoritarianism. So it's due next Christmas, so I'm a little ahead of the game. But I had a bolt of inspiration while teaching the baby to swim today. The other news, April 1st to 4th, 2010, if you're in Seattle, I hope to see you because I'll be one of the guests of honor at NorwestCon, which is a great regional science fiction convention. In either October or November, the dates are still being finalized, of 2009, Makers, my next novel, is coming out from Tor and HarperCollins UK in the UK and the rest of the Commonwealth. And the Little Brother paperback, the US Little Brother paperback, which will be out in the US and Canada, has been pushed to March 2010 because the hardcover is selling so well, so you won't get any complaint from me there. Well, that's it, and now on with the reading of my 2005 novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Talk to you later. He parked the rental car in the driveway, finishing his cell phone conversation with Lyman, and then popping the trunk before getting out. He glanced reflexively up at Mimi and Krishna's windows, saw that the blinds were still drawn. When he got to the living room, Mimi was bent over a suitcase, forcing it closed. Two more were lined up beside the door, along with three shopping bags filled with Tupperwares and Ziplocs of food from his fridge. "I borrowed some of your clothes," she said. "Didn't want to have to go back for mine. Packed us a picnic, too." He planted his hands on his hips. "You thought of everything, huh?" She cast her eyes down. "I'm sorry," she said in a small voice. "I couldn't go home." Her wings unfolded and folded down again, nervously. He went and stood next to her. He could smell the sex on her and on him. A livid hickey stood out on her soft skin, on her throat. He twined her fingers in his and dropped his face down to her ear. "It's okay," he said huskily. "I'm glad you did it." She turned her head and brushed her lips over his, brushed her hand over his groin. He groaned softly. "We have to get driving," he said. "Yes," she said. "Load the car, then bring it around the side. I'll lie down on the back seat until we're out of the neighborhood." "You thought about this a lot, huh?" "It's all I've thought of," she said. She climbed over the back seat once they cleared Queen Street, giggling as her wings, trapped under her jacket, brushed the roof of the big Crown Victoria he'd rented. She prodded at the radio and found a college station, staticky and amateurish, and nodded her head along with the mashup mixes and concert bootlegs the DJ was spinning. Alan watched her in the rearview and felt impossibly old and strange. She'd been an incredible and attentive lover, using her hands and mouth, her breasts and wings, her whole body to keep him quivering on the brink of orgasm, for what felt like hours before finally giving him release, and then had guided him around her body with explicit instructions and firm hands on his shoulders. When she came, she squeezed him between her thighs and screamed into his neck, twitching and shuddering for a long time afterward, holding him tight, murmuring nonsense and hot breath. In the dark, she'd seemed older, his age, or some indeterminate age. Now, sitting next to him, privately spazzing out to the beat, she seemed, oh, 12 or so, a little girl.
He felt dirty. "Where are we going?" she said, rolling down the window and shouting over the wind as they bombed up the Don Valley Parkway. The traffic had let up at Shepherd, and now they were making good time, headed for the faceless suburbs of Richmond Hill and Thornhill and beyond. "North," he said, "past Kappa's Casing." She whistled. "How long a drive is it?" 15 hours, 20 maybe, depends on the roads. You can hit cottage traffic or a bad accident and get hung up for hours. There are good motels between Huntsville and North Bay, and if we get tired out. Nice neon signs, magic fingers beds. A place I like has Swiss cabins and makes a nice roasty for dinner. "God, that's a long trip," she said. "Yeah," he said, wondering if she wanted out. "I can pull off here and give you cab fare to the subway station if you want to stay." "No," she said quickly. "No, want to go." She fed him as he drove, slicing cheese and putting it on crackers with bits of olive or pepper or salami. It appeared that she'd packed his entire fridge in the picnic bags. After supper time, she went to work on an apple, and he took a closer look at the knife she was using. It was a big black hunting knife with a compass built into the handle. The blade was black, except right at the edge, where it gleamed sharp in the click-clack of the passing highway lights. He was transfixed by it, and the car drifted a little, sprayed gravel from the shoulder, and he overcorrected and fishtailed a little. She looked up in alarm. "You brought the knife," he said, in response to her unasked question. "Couldn't leave it with him," she said. "Besides, a sharp knife is handy." "Careful you don't slice anything off, okay?"
"Why, never cut anything off unintentionally," she said in a silly, dramatic voice, and socked him in the shoulder.
He snorted and went back to the driving, putting the hammer down, eating up the kilometers towards Huntsville and beyond. She fed him slices of apple and ate some herself, then rolls of ham with little pieces of pear in them, then sips of cherry juice from a glass bottle. "Enough," he said at last. "I'm stuffed, woman." She laughed. "Skinny little fucker. Gotta put some meat on your bones." She tidied the dinner detritus into an empty shopping bag and tossed it over her shoulder into the back seat. "So," she said, "how long since you've been home?" He stared at the road for a while. 15 years, he said. "Never been back since I left." She stared straight forward and worked her hand under his thigh so that he was sitting on it, and then wriggled her knuckles. "I've never been home," she said. He wrinkled his brow. "What's that mean?" he said. "It's a long story," she said. "Well, let's get off the highway and get a room, and you can tell me, okay?" "Sure," she said. They ended up at the Timberline Wilderness Lodge and Pancake House, and Mimi clapped her hands at the silk flowers and waterbeds ambiance of the room, fondled the grizzly jackalope head on the wall, and started running a tub while Alan carried in the suitcases. She dramatically tossed her clothes, one at a time, out the bathroom door, and through the clouds of steam, and he caught a glimpse of her round, full ass, bracketed by those restless wings, as she poured into the tub the bottle of cheap bubble bath she'd bought in the lobby. He dug a t-shirt and a fresh pair of boxers to sleep in out of his suitcase, feeling ridiculously modest as he donned them. His feet crunched over the cigarette burns and tangles in the brown shag carpet, and he wished he'd brought along some slippers. He flipped through both snowy TV channels and decided that he couldn't stomach a televangelist or a 30-year-old sitcom right then, and flicked it off, sitting on the edge of the bed, listening to the splashing from the bathroom. Mimi was in awfully good spirits, considering what she'd been through with Krishna. He tried to think about it, trying to make sense of the day and the girl, but the splashing from the tub kept intruding on his thoughts. She began to sing, and after a second he recognized the tune, White Rabbit by the Jefferson Airplane. Not the kind of thing he'd expect her to be giving voice to, nor she, apparently, for she kept breaking off to giggle. Finally, he poked his head through the door. She was folded into the tub, knees and tits above the foam line, wings slick with water and dripping in the tile. Her hands were out of sight beneath the suds. She caught his eye and grinned crazily. Then her hand shot out of the pool, clutching the hunting knife. "Put on the White Rabbit!" she howled, cackling fiendishly. He leapt back, and she continued to cackle. "Come back! Come back!" she choked. "I'm doing the tub scene from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I thought you were into reading." He cautiously peeked around the door jamb, playing it up for comic effect. "Give me the knife," he said. "Aw," she said, handing it over butt first. He set it down on the dresser, then hurried back to the bathroom. "Haven't you read all those books?" Alan grinned. What's the point of a bunch of books you've already read? He dropped the boxers and stripped off his t-shirt and clambered in the tub, sloshing gallons of water over the scummy tile floor. When I was 2 years old, she said later, as she reclined against the headboard and he reclined against her, their asses deforming the rusted springs of the mattress so that it sloped toward them, and the tins of soda they'd opened to replenish their body fluids, lost in sweat and otherwise, threatened to tip over the on the slope. She encased him in her wings, shutting out the light and filling the air with the smell of cinnamon and pepper from the downy hair. When I was 2 years old, she said, speaking into the shaggy hair at the back of his neck, as his sore muscles trembled, and as the sweat dried to a white salt residue on his skin, as he lay there in the dark of the room, and the wings, watching the constellation of reflected clock radio lights in the black TV screen. When I was 2 years old, she began, her body tensing from toes to tip in a movement that he felt along the length of his body, portending the time when lovers close their eyes and open their mouths and utter the secrets that they hide from everyone, even themselves. When I was 2 years old, my wings were the size of a cherub's, and they had featherlets that were white as snow. I lived with my aunt, an old Russian lady, near Downsview Air Force Base, a blasted suburb where the shops all closed on Saturday for Sabbath, and the black-hatted Hussids marked the days by walking from one end to the other on their way to temple. The old Russian lady took me out for walks in the big black baby buggy the size of a bathtub. She tucked me in tight so that my wings were pinned beneath me, but when we were at home in her little apartment with the wind-up Sputnik that played the Internationale, she would let my wings out and light the candles and watch me wobble around the room, my wings flapping, her chin in her hands, her eyes bright. She made me mashed up cabbage and seed and beef and bottles of diluted juice. For dessert we had hard candies, and I toddle around with my toys, drooling sugar syrup while the old Russian lady watched. By the time I was 4, the feathers had all fallen out, and I was supposed to go to school. I knew that. Auntie had explained to me that the kids I saw passing by were on their way to school, and that some day I'd go and learn, too. She didn't speak much English, so I grew up speaking a creole of Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, and English, and I used my words to ask her, with more and more insistence, when I'd get to go to class. But I couldn't read or write, and neither could she. But I could take apart gadgets like nobody's business. Somebody, maybe Auntie's long-dead husband, had left her a junky toolkit with cracked handles and chipped tips. I attacked anything that I could get unplugged from the wall, the big cabinet TV and radio, the suitcase record player, the Sputnik music box. I unwired the lamps and peered at the workings of the electric kitchen clock. That was 4. 5 was the year I put it all back together again. I started with the lamps, then the motor in the blender, then the toaster elements. I made the old TV work. I don't think I knew how any of it really worked. I couldn't tell you a thing about, you know, electrical engineering, but I just got a sense of how it was supposed to go together. Auntie didn't let me out of the apartment after 5. I could watch the kids go by from the window, skinny Hasids with side curls and Filipinos with pretty ribbons and teenagers who smoked, but I couldn't go to them. I watched Sesame Street and Mr. Dress-Up, and I began to soak up English. I began to soak up the idea of playing with other kids. I began to soak up the fact that none of the kids on TV had wings. Auntie left me alone in the afternoons when she went out shopping and banking and whatever else it was she did, and it was during those times that I could get into her bedroom and go rooting around her things. She had a lot of mysterious beige foundation garments that were utterly inexplicable, and a little box of jewelry that I liked to taste, because real gold tasted really rich when I sucked on it, and a stack of old cigarette tins filled with frayed photos. The pictures were stiff and mysterious. Faces loomed out of the featureless black backgrounds. Pop-eyed, jug-eared Russian farm boys. Awkward farm girls with process waves in their hair. Everyone looking like they'd been stuffed and mounted. I guess they were her relatives, because if you squinted at them and cocked your head, you could kind of see her features in theirs. But not saggy and wrinkled and three-chinned, but young and tight and almost glowing. They all had big shoulders and clothing that looked like the kind of thing the Chassids wore, black and sober. The faces were interesting, especially after I figured out that one of them might belong to Auntie, but it was the blackness around them that fascinated me. The boys had black suits and the girls wore black dresses, and behind them was creased blackness, complete darkness, as though they'd put their heads through a black curtain. But the more I stared at the blackness, the more detail I picked out. I noticed the edge of a curtain, a fold in one photo, and when I looked for it, I could pick it out in the other photos. Eventually, I hit on the idea of using a water glass as a magnifying lens, and then I experimented with different levels of water, more detail leaping out of the old pictures. The curtains hanging behind them were dusty and wrinkled. They looked like they were made of crushed velvet, like the Niagara Falls souvenir pillow on Auntie's armchair in the living room, which had whorls of paisley trimmed into them. I traced these whorls with my eye and tried to reproduce them with ballpoint on paper bags I found under the sink. And then, in one of the photos, I noticed that the patterns disappeared behind and above the shoulders. I experimented with different water levels in my glass to bring up the magnification, and I diligently sketched. I'd seen a Polka Dot Door episode where the host showed you how you could draw a grid over an original image and a matching grid on a sheet of blank paper, and then copy over every square, reproducing the image in manageable, bite-sized chunks. That's what I did, using the edge of a nail file for a ruler, drawing my grid carefully on the plastic bag, and a matching one on the picture, using the blunt tip of a dead pen to make a grid of indentations in the surface of the photo. And I sketched it out, one square at a time, where the pattern was, where it wasn't, what shadows the negative absence of pattern took in the photos. As I drew, day after day, I realized that I was drawing the shape of something black that was blocking the curtain behind. Then I got excited. I drew in my steadiest hand, tracing each curve, using my magnifier until I had the shape drawn and defined, and long before I finished, I knew what I was drawing, and I drew it anyway. I drew it, and then I looked at my paper sack, and I saw that what I had drawn was a pair of wings, black and powerful, spread out and stretching out of the shot. She curled the prehensile tips of her wings up the soles of his feet, making him go yeek and jump in the bed. "Are you awake?" she said, twisting her head around to brush her lips over his. "Wrapped," he said. She giggled and her tits bounced. "Good," she said, "'cause this is the important part." Auntie came home early that day and found me sitting at her vanity with the photos and the water glass and the drawings on the paper sacks spread out before me. Our eyes met for a moment. Her pupils shrank down to tiny dots. I remember seeing them vanish, leaving rings of yellowed hazel. One of her hands lashed out in a claw and sank into my hair. She lifted me out of the chair by my hair before I'd even had a chance to cry out, almost before I'd registered the fact that she was hurting me. She'd never so much as spanked me until then. She was strong in that slow old Russian lady way, strong enough to grunt 10 sacks of groceries in a bundle buggy up the stairs to the apartment. When she picked me up and tossed me, it was like being fired out of a cannon. I rebounded off the frame motel room art over the bed, shattering the glass, and bounced twice on the mattress before coming to rest on the floor. My arm was hanging at a funny angle, and when I tried to move it, it hurt so much that I heard a high sound in my ears, like a dog whistle. I lay still as the old lady yanked the drawers out of her vanity and upended them onto the floor until she found an old book of matches. She swept the photos and my sketches into the tin wastebasket, then lit a match with trembling hands and dropped it in. It went out. She repeated it, and on the fourth try, she got the idea of using the match to light all the remaining matches in the folder and drop that into the bin. A moment later, it was burning cheerfully, spitting curly red embers into the air on clouds of dark smoke. I buried my face in the matted carpet and tried not to hear that high note, tried to will away the sick, grating feeling in my upper arm. She was wreathed in smoke, choking, when she finally turned to me. For a moment I refused to meet her eye, sure that she would kill me if I did, would see the guilt and the knowledge in my face, and keep her secret with murder. I'd watched enough daytime television to know about dark secrets. But when she bent down to me with the creak of stretching elastic, she lifted me to my feet and bent to look me in the eye, and she had tears in her eyes. She went to her pile of oddments and junk jewelry that she had dumped out on the floor and sorted through it until she found a pair of sewing shears, and then she cut away my t-shirt, supporting my broken arm with her hand. My wings were flapping nervously in the fabric, and it got tangled, and she took firm hold of the wingtips and folded them down to my back and freed the shirt and tossed it in the pile of junk on her normally spotless floor. She had spoken to me less and less since I had fixed the television and begun to pick up English, and now she was wordless as she gently rotated my finger bones and my wrist bones, my elbow and my shoulder, minute movements, listening for my tea kettle hiss when she hit the sore spots. "Is broken," she said. "Cholera," she said. "I'm so sorry loving you," she said.